I would say to any writer, and any writer who might be listening, trying to write in a different form, trying to write in a different genre, it's not that dissimilar from taking a trip from one's usual surroundings and just inhabiting a different landscape. And in the same way that when you go to a different country, you mess up and you say the wrong thing and you make all kinds of mistakes, crossing over in genres is similar, right? I mean, I made so many mistakes with this novel that I would like to think I wouldn't make again on the first and second draft of it.
It's Shelf Life. On this episode, Office Life, as seen in Then We Came to the End by Joshua Ferris, and in The Men Can't Be Saved, the funny sad debut by my guest, Ben Perkert. And we head to Spain in the company of a young, lustful, hash-smoking poet, not beyond telling a few useful lies in Ben Lerner's Leaving the Atocha Station. Stay with us.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dan Ronan. President Trump said today the U.S. is beginning a naval blockade of the Strait of Hormuz. And if Iran attacks any U.S. vessel or friendly ship in the waterway, he said they will, quote, be blown to hell. Trump also accused Iran of extortion for attempting to collect fees from shippers to move through the narrow passageway. Trump was asked on Fox News about NATO's response to the war and efforts to reopen the strait.
We're very disappointed with NATO. We're very, very disappointed that they didn't come. Now they want to come and they want to help with the strait, and it won't take long to clean it out. So we're going to clean out the strait, and they'll be able to use the strait in not too long a distance.
Trump said Iran is refusing to give up its demand to have nuclear weapons. He says the U.S. will not allow that. The marathon negotiations between American and Iranian delegations ended without a breakthrough on ending the war in Iran. The talks in Islamabad, Pakistan, collapsed overnight. The two sides are blaming each other. NPR's Dee Parvaz reports the meeting came after the two countries agreed to a temporary ceasefire.
In a statement to Iranian state media, Iran's foreign ministry spokesperson Esmaeil Baghaei said that the two sides, quote, reached an understanding on a number of issues, but ultimately the talks did not lead to an agreement. He added that issues such as Iran's demand that it continue to control the Strait of Hormuz added complexities to the talks and that, quote, we should not have expected to reach an agreement in one meeting from the beginning. After the collapse of the talks, Vice President J.D. Vance said that the U.S. needs a commitment from Iran that it will not seek a nuclear weapon nor pursue the tools to quickly build one. Iran has repeatedly said that the nuclear program is a civilian one and that it has a right to continue to enrich uranium for that purpose. The status of the two-week ceasefire is uncertain at this point, as are the possibilities of further negotiations. Dee Parvaz, NPR News, Vaughan, Turkey.
Vice President J.D. Vance left Pakistan after the talks ended. He is now returning to Washington, D.C. Voter turnout in Hungary is reported to be heavier than normal in past elections as citizens decide the fate of the country's longtime Prime Minister Viktor Orban. Reporter Esme Nicholson in Budapest says the challenger, Peter Maigar, has run a strong campaign focusing on government corruption as the economy in the country has stalled.
Domestically, this election is about the economy, which is stagnant. Inflation is high and ordinary Hungarians are really struggling to make ends meet while they watch Viktor Orban, the Prime Minister, and his inner circle appear to get visibly richer. And discontent about this apparent disparity is something that Orban's challenger, Péter Magyar, has seized upon.
Last week, Vice President J.D. Vance traveled to Budapest in Hungary for a campaign event with Orban. You're listening to NPR News. Russia and Ukraine are accusing each other of violating a Kremlin-declared ceasefire so both nations could celebrate the Orthodox Easter holiday. Thursday, Russian President Vladimir Putin declared a 32-hour halt to the fighting from 4 p.m. Saturday till the end of Sunday. Ukraine's military said in that time there were nearly 2,300 ceasefire violations, including drone flights, shelling, and other assaults. Russia claims Ukraine violated the ceasefire nearly 2,000 times. The war, which Russia began, has now lasted more than 4 years. It is the final round at the Augusta National Masters Golf Tournament today. Northern Ireland's Rory McIlroy has a chance to make history. Steve Futterman reports.
On Saturday, Rory McIlroy was in great position. He was on top with a 6-stroke lead. Entering today's final round, he was still on top, but no longer alone. He was in a two-way tie with American Cameron Young. McIlroy had a tough third round. He was one over par. Still, he was trying to look at the upside.
You know, I'm still tied for the best score, so I can't forget that. But I do know I'm going to have to be better if I want to have a chance to win.
McIlroy is the defending champion. If he wins today, he would become only the fourth golfer ever to win back-to-back Masters, joining Nick Faldo, Jack Nicklaus, and Tiger Woods. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in Augusta, Georgia.
There is an election today in Peru. Voters there are choosing a president from a roster of 35 candidates running for office. The winner of the election will be Peru's ninth president in 10 years. I'm Dan Ronan, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, investing in creative thinkers and problem solvers who help people, communities, and the planet flourish. More information is available at Hewlett.org.
I would say to any writer, and any writer who might be listening, trying to write in a different form, trying to write in a different genre, it's not that dissimilar from taking a trip from one's usual surroundings and just inhabiting a different landscape. And in the same way that when you go to a different country, you mess up and you say the wrong thing and you make all kinds of mistakes, crossing over in genres is similar, right? I mean, I made so many mistakes with this novel that I would like to think I wouldn't make again on the first and second draft of it.
Hello and welcome to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hickler. Hello. Three debut novels are the focus of this episode of Shelf Life, and all three touch on the existential angst at the heart of what we now refer to as late-stage capitalism. All three also happen to be wry, poignant, and often very funny. The first is Joshua Ferris's 2007 novel, Then We Came to the End, set in an ad agency during the implosion of the dot-com era, and largely told in the collective voice of the white-collar workers who are being fired at breakneck speed. The second is Ben Lerner's Leaving the Atocha Station, in which an aimless American student on a poetry fellowship in Madrid frets about the limits of language and of poetry while lying about his parents to gain sympathy from the women in his life. The third is The Men Can't Be Saved, the debut novel of my guest Ben Perkert, in which a New York City copywriter finds his life rapidly coming apart. Perkert started the novel in 2014, long before the Me Too movement made the novel's concern with masculinity extra prescient. He has said, "I'm very interested in how toxic masculinity is learned and how we can undo some of that damage and strive for something better. The male gaze is very harmful to those it objectifies, but it's also harmful to the one gazing." Ben Perkert, welcome to Shelf Life.
Thank you so much for having me.
Ben, the books you've chosen to talk about today, as well as your own novel, The Men Can't Be Saved, all suggest that life is messy, often soulless, and ultimately disappointing. Is that broadly your view?
Oh, no, we're starting there. Well, there's the view that I have, and then there's the views of the books. You know, I think books that have inherent comedy, they can't be nihilistic, just by virtue of the fact that they are making that effort toward a kind of lightness. So I'm not sure that my worldview is an entirely bleak one. Having said that, I am drawn to writers who poke and who have a sort of edge and are able to peel back some of the layers of daily absurdity that we all endure. And I don't think those layers are ever as thick as they are in the American workplace.
Your debut novel, The Men Can't Be Saved, is set in the workplace, a branding agency, and it focuses on two men in particular, Seth Taranoff and Robert Moon McClune. Though Seth is the novel's protagonist, both are very complicated men. Seth
verges on being a serial harasser, while McClone is an alcoholic who epitomizes a certain kind of male swagger. He even says to Taranoff, I think at one point, we'll always land on our feet, which seems to me a textbook definition, if ever there was one, of white male privilege. But by the novel's end, you've revealed them to really be masters of self-deception. I can't help wondering whether these men are based on men in your own life or men you've observed at close quarters.
Or let's be honest, the worst parts of myself, right? I can't exclude that piece either. You know, it's always an uncomfortable conversation, I think, to peel apart what is fiction and autofiction and to what extent autobiography leads into the writing of something like a novel. I want it to be a more complicated process than that. I don't want to believe that it's one-to-one. All that being said, in the writing of this book, I was absolutely thinking about men who I've known and how could I put them down on the page. I'm not particularly proud to talk about this, but I was a member of a fraternity in college, and the bluster and the ego and the loudness and frankly the charisma that you see in an environment like that among men, even when I was young, I mean, it was both really gross to me and also literally and metaphorically intoxicating. And I wanted to create a character like Moon who is so deeply offensive, while at the same time, I at least had a hard time looking away from him. And I think that as the chapters wear on, we see peaks into a kind of intellect and sensitivity that he has that our main character may not possess.
You said you're not proud of your time in a fraternity at college. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah. Well, I mean, even if you just think about the word fraternity, it's a really beautiful promise. And when I started writing this book in 2014, it didn't feel like masculinity was really centered in any sort of conversation. Obviously, men center themselves in any conversation, but masculinity as something that we needed to take seriously from a societal standpoint, I don't remember that being talked about much. And now it feels like every 2 minutes I'm seeing another article about the chronic loneliness of men and the inability to maintain friendships later in life and how that contributes to depression and falling out of the workplace and all of these things. And as an antidote to something like loneliness, the promise, and I'm using that word very intentionally, of a fraternity, I think, is a really beautiful thing. In practice, you know, it's abused in so many ways. And when I say I'm not proud of it, you know, in the same way that a lot of us, if we looked back on how we were in high school or college, we made certain decisions that we might not make today. But when I think about my characters, my main character, Seth, he's obsessed with making partner. That is his goal. And he thinks he's going to get there. And pretty quickly, it's clear to our readers that he is not, that he's going to fall really short of that goal. But if you think about a word like partner, you know, for him, it's just a title, right? He wants the corner office. But if he were a bit more honest with himself, I think he would admit that actually what he wants is partnership. What he wants is companionship. What he wants is friendship. What he wants actually is fraternity. Lowercase f, right? He wants to feel that connection. So that to me is what makes him such a compelling and tragicomic figure, is that he wants the business title, but in fact, the need is so much deeper than he realizes.
Your protagonist, Seth Taranoff, who we're talking about here, believes he's successful, believes he is indispensable to the agency. He coins a very successful branding line for a line of men's diapers called Smackdale. But actually, it materializes that one success does not define him, that most of his colleagues think of him as a kind of joke. Is he as unaware as he appears to be through the novel, that he's not cracked up to be the ace copywriter that he believes?
Well, I think it's an open question for the reader. I was interviewing the novelist Antoine Wilson the other day. He wrote Mouth to Mouth. It's really good. And I was talking to Antoine, and he said this thing that will always stick with me. He said that when a novel or any piece of fiction is written in the first person, what you're getting is the PR department. you're getting the interior monologue as told through the eyes of a particular consciousness that wants you to think a particular thing. I mean, it's not that dissimilar from advertising in a sense. Hmm. So The Men Can't Be Saved is written all in the first person, and all we ever hear is Seth's perspective, really. So it's hard to get any objective read on him. And I feel that as the writer, too. To what extent right. was he this viral sensation who turned this no-name brand for an adult men's diaper? To what extent was that a colossal win? Or was it just this flash in the pan for a joke of a company that no one takes seriously? And part of the fun, frankly, of writing this novel was riding both tracks. And I think that's the case for all of us and how we think about our professional achievements. I could tell you publications that I've had that I'm so proud of that convince me that I am a worthy writer, that I'm a man of letters, and then catch me on a different day and I'll tell you I've achieved nothing. You know, my work is worthless. Right. And so it's all a matter of perspective. And Seth is certainly on one side of that perspective. And we've worked with people like that. You know, they have one thing and all they want to do is megaphone about it to anyone who will listen.
It also illuminated for me the sense, and it's very true in journalism and writing more broadly, and maybe all the creative arts, that you're only really as good as your most recent project, mm-hmm. that the thing you created is forgotten very quickly by the rest of the world. It moves on. When Seth materializes at his lowest point in a drugstore in Allentown, Pennsylvania, and sees these adult diapers, he discovers that his branding line has been removed, has been replaced. It's a kind of low point, but it also exemplifies that these successes we have are fleeting.
And it also, frankly, it mirrors my experience working as a copywriter in the branding world, not the adult diaper part. I never sank quite that low. But, you know, everyone wants to write the next Just Do It, right? The Nike tagline. And everyone right. points to that line as being like a piece of scripture, right? It just doesn't change. And it's so fundamental to the DNA of the brand. But part of the reason people talk about Nike is there just frankly aren't that many examples of taglines that have endured all that long. And part of that is because as a society, we get bored and we want something new. And part of it is also that all the incentives that agencies have is to replace and refresh. But copywriters like myself and graphic designers, we want to believe that the work that we're doing will endure and have some sort of meaning.
You and Joshua Ferris, who we'll be talking about, both worked in advertising. He has said that when he worked in advertising, he felt his life was draining away. How did you feel?
On the one hand, I feel the same. But I will say with one caveat, I miss and I'm nostalgic for working at an agency because of the camaraderie. Writing can be a really lonely business. At least it is for me. I spent about a decade working on this book. That was not a decade spent with friends. That was not a decade spent, you know, laughing and getting coffee. I mean, a lot of it was spent, frankly, in front of a laptop, doubting the quality of my own work, revising it until I was as close to happy with it as I could be. And when I think back on the work that I did at the agency, I didn't really care about the products that we were trying to sell, but I did care about the people. And there's a particular energy that I think a show like Mad Men just captured so well. When you have a designer and a writer and you team them up, like that collaboration, that feels very close to art to me. And has a sense of community that I miss. So I agree with Ferris in the sense that I did find it really soul-sucking in a deep way, but I can't brush past that because the electricity of the agency, that's what made me want to write this novel. There were so many characters. How could I not put them in a book?
You're listening to Shelf Life with me, Aaron Hicklin, and my guest today, the author and poet, Ben Perkert. His book, The Men Can't Be Saved, is published by Overlook Press. Ben, let's talk about Leaving the Atosha Station by Ben Lerner. It's an extremely confident first novel. in which Adam Gordon, an American student on a poetry fellowship in Spain, is supposed to be composing a data-driven poem about responses to history. Instead, he spends a lot of his time taking drugs, drinking, falling in love, sort of, and trying to ascertain if it is possible to be authentic, to be real, or is everything as fraudulent as he fears. Much of the book is about this conversation he's having about language inside his head and what translation is. There's a lot of self-scrutiny, a lot of neurosis. I'm curious, what led you to this novel?
Well, you know, because Lerner was a poet that I loved, I was going to read whatever he put out, whether it was poetry or fiction. But it was thrilling to encounter this book. And one of the things that I remember most vividly reading it was this question of, am I having an authentic experience of art? And as a neurotic person myself, I really related to that. You know, I spend a lot of time going to poetry readings, for example, and especially when I was in grad school. And I'd be sitting in the poetry reading and I'd be thinking, am I having an authentic experience of art right now? Am I moved by this? Am I performing? To what extent am I being true? And for me, part of the genius of the way that Lerner conveys this is that, of course, as I'm reading the novel, I'm having a deeply authentic experience with art. I'm loving Ben Lerner's novel, right? But part of the reason I'm loving it is because it's forcing me to question, how am I loving it? Am I really loving it? Or is it helpful to me in some way to go to a party, if I were invited to one, and say, oh yeah, you know, Ben Lerner's new novel is so genius, right? He's so good at tapping into the games that the brain plays on itself. And, you know, Lerner's protagonist is, I would say he's more perceptive in some ways than my protagonist, but we're dealing with two very neurotic Jewish protagonists, let's be honest.
I love as well, at the most basic level, the way that Ben Lerner is able to summon or convey the atmosphere of a party or a gathering. And there's a funny early scene where, against his wishes, Adam Gordon is introduced as a major American poet at a reading in the upmarket neighborhood of Salamanca in Madrid by his friend Arturo. And he's preceded by a Spanish poet, Thomas, who, in Adam's words, looked less like he was going to read poetry and more like he was going to sing flamenco or weep. Thomas's work is so earnest and histrionic that Adam wonders if it's parody. I have to ask if you've been at poetry readings like that. Did you recognize that experience?
Well, now you're just trying to get me in trouble. I mean, of course, right? I've been to a gazillion poetry readings. And so I've seen poets of all stripes and poets who approach it in lots of different ways and deeply ironic poets who want to bury sentiment as deep as they possibly can. And then other poets who wear their heart on their sleeve. And I love that about it. But yes, the answer to your question is yes, I have been to those poetry readings for sure.
And what is your take on what Lerner is saying about poetry in this novel?
Well, I think, you know, I want to leave his novel as it is, as a work of fiction, and not try to speculate what Lerner thinks philosophically behind it. But if you've read Ben Lerner's really short book, The Hatred of Poetry, he delves into that a little bit about, you know, why is it that certain people just have this distaste for poetry? And then alternatively, why do some of us just love it and hold it up as this incredibly vaulted art form? There's no one who is at once more disrespected in society than a poet. And at the same time, there's no one who is held in higher esteem. That word poet, it has the capital P in it. I could tell people, yeah, I wrote a novel, I'm a novelist. That doesn't have quite the same cachet. It doesn't also feel, frankly, as laughable as introducing yourself as a poet. I am a poet. So, you know, I think Lerner is interested in looking at all of that. And I am too.
As a poet yourself, how would you persuade someone that poetry is for them, that poetry is something worth reading and listening to?
I got to be honest. I think we spend a lot of time straining to persuade. I think that a lot of poetry spends itself on its heels a little bit. And maybe this is my own advertising background coming out a little bit. But one of the things that I learned early on was, if you've got a new brand and you want people to trust that brand, the worst thing you can say is, trust us, right? It immediately sounds dishonest. It sounds shady. I'm not going to trust a brand that tells me to trust it. There's a little bit of that thou doth protest too much with some poetry outreach for my taste. I'm not impugning or hating on how anyone goes about it. And I'm really deeply moved by people who have made such an effort to bring poetry to communities. But I wish sometimes that we were a bit more confident in what poetry does and allowed people to experience it or not with just a little bit more freedom. I have a toddler, and the minute I try to push that vegetable, and I know that vegetable is healthy, right? That asparagus is going to make him big and strong and give him the nutrients he needs. But the minute I give indications of that, I know that it's going on the ground. So we have something rich in nutrients. I love poetry. It was my way into literature. I will always love it. I will always write poems. But that doesn't mean that my neighbor needs to read them necessarily.
Something that both you and Ben Lerner have in common with your books is that balance of comedy and pathos. It's a very hard balance, it would seem, to get right. How did you get it right?
Well, thanks for the compliment. I'm drawn to work that is hard to classify. I really love Succession. I know a lot of people love Succession. Some people don't like Succession. But part of what I loved about Succession was that it didn't live comfortably in either genre. Was that a comedy? Yes, it absolutely was a comedy. Was it a drama? Oh, it absolutely was a drama. You know what I'm saying? And
yeah.
Isn't that what life is? I'm constantly brought to tears laughing about that happens in my day. And then at other moments, I'm so deeply sad that I can't even imagine laughing. And that to me is part of the joy of writing and the joy of art, is that you get to bring both sides. And the writer Sigrid Nunez, who I really love, she wrote this thing that I never forgot, which was that she could never completely love a novel. She could admire a novel, but she could not completely love a novel that did not have at least a bit of humor in it. And when I read that, I immediately identified with it, because there are so many novels that I respect and admire tremendously that aren't funny. But all the ones that I really, really love, they find ways to laugh at themselves and admit some of that light into a dark space. So it wasn't a conscious thing. I wasn't trying to pipette the right amount of comedy versus drama. It just, I sort of vacillate between both so quickly. And I think that shows up in the book.
Well, let's hear an excerpt from Leaving the Atocha Station by Ben Lerner, which captures that beautiful balance between comedy and pathos. This is from the beginning of section 3 of Leaving the Atocha Station.
Instead of confessing to Isabel that my mother, my brilliant and unwaveringly supportive mother, was well, that I was a liar of the most disgusting sort, I decided to imply more and more that my father, the gentlest and most generous man I knew, was a thug, a small-time fascist, el caudillo of his household. Not only did this lie, in my view, draw Isabel's attention away from whatever discomfort she had regarding the initial dishonesty about my mom, replacing that discomfort with sympathy, but it also served to decrease my guilt. I felt much better about blaspheming both my parents, about distributing my failure as a son between them. And because this lie about my father was comically absurd, because he was the man of all the men I knew most free from any will to domination, it felt more like a harmless joke than a morbid tempting of fate or karmic gambling with parental health. I also felt that, in order to avoid any future confusion, I needed to get my story straight, and so decided to replay the confession I had made to Isabel and Rufina to Teresa, who would then tell Arturo and Rafa, all of whom believed I had, when we first met, recently suffered one of life's profoundest losses, Surely some part of the mystery I like to think I held for Teresa derived from the fact that, after my first dramatic performance at the party, I made no subsequent reference to my suffering, although suffering could be read into my silences. That I was thousands of miles away from the rest of my family so soon after such a tragedy, although I never specified the time frame, prepared the ground for my lie about my impossible father and my new claim that I might not return to the U.S. after the completion of my fellowship furthered my image as exile. At any rate, when the rains and early dark began to give way to warmer, longer days and milder nights, and the accordion player was back in La Plaza Santa Ana, and the streets were again alive, I began to see more of Teresa, who did not seem to have a job, although in theory she was employed at the gallery. I would walk to Salamanca after working in El Retiro, and Teresa would leave the gallery in someone else's hands and accompany me to movies, bookstores, cafes.
And that was Leaving the Atocha Station by Ben Lerner, narrated there by Ben Lerner himself. Ben, we just listened to the section in which Adam Gordon confesses to Teresa that his mother isn't actually dead and that his father is a fascist. It's it's a very funny scene and a troubling scene. As someone who has created an unreliable narrator yourself in The Men Can't Be Saved, how did you feel about Adam Gordon's dissembling in this novel?
And I love that line about the, you know, my father couldn't even kill a spider, right? On the one hand, it's you know, that he's this horrible fascist, but then the reality is so completely different. And that's so much of the comedy for Lerner. I mean, you're being very polite. You're saying unreliable narrator. In that wonderful accent that you have. But let's be honest, right? Adam Gordon is a liar, and Seth Tarnoff for my book is also a liar. And it can be fun, right? I was talking about this with a friend the other day. Unreliable narrators, unlikable narrators. It's different than unlikable people. Like, I don't want to live next to an unlikable person. I don't want to be neighbors with someone who's cruel and unlikable and is a liar. But I will absolutely spend 200 or 300 pages in their brain. Because that sounds like a weird and wild place to be. That's not to say that the only good narrators are distasteful people, but I have wonderful people in my life who I get to spend real time with. So in fiction, take me somewhere a little bit darker and deceptive. Let's go there, right? Those are the books that I'm interested in.
You've said that at college, in order to cultivate an idea of yourself as a reader, it meant dispensing with certain presentations of masculinity that you had been sold or presented with through your life. I wonder if we can circle in on that a little and explain what you mean by that.
Yeah, most of the writers worth reading, in my experience, are voracious readers and were voracious readers from a very early age. And I feel like I've been playing catch up my entire life because I was not a voracious reader at a very young age. I always wanted to be a writer. I always wanted to project and be heard. And I say that not without some amount of shame and embarrassment. It's not that I wasn't bookish because I was a huge nerd, but there were certain people that I knew and writers who are friends of mine now that, you know, their childhood was just spent reading. And I've had fantasies of being a writer, a published writer, my whole life. And I don't think that that is entirely divorced from questions of gender and the fact that to perform a certain masculinity was to be loud and to have one's voice heard. So, you know, only later, like even writing this novel, the first draft I wrote really quickly without a depth of understanding of the American novel tradition. But after I had that draft, that's when I had to go deep. And that's when I spent 9.5 years just reading as many novels as I possibly could to get smart about the genre and on some level to make up for gaps in that education.
I want to ask you about the beginning of At the Atocha Station, because it starts with Adam describing his daily routine, which includes an espresso and a spliff in the morning, and then a visit to the Prado Museum, where he sits in front of a painting. Then one morning, he arrives to find another young man there who mysteriously breaks down and sobs. At that point, I was under the impression that this crying young man was going to lead somewhere in the novel. But the scene is just left there for us to ponder. And maybe this is where the sort of poet comes in. We never really meet the young man again or discover why he was crying. I wonder how you interpreted or read that scene or how it made you feel.
Yeah, you know, for me, I think it relates back to that question of, am I having an authentic experience of art? If this person is doing it in front of every single painting, then it starts to feel sort of fake, right? It feels artificial. But on the other hand, we can't enter his interiority. The novel's not told from his perspective. So maybe each piece of art is deeply moving him in that way. And of course, Lerner and Lerner's protagonist being an observer, a keen observer, is leaving us to wrestle with those questions for ourselves. This is part of the reason I think that I love when poets write novels, because exactly for the reason you described, I think that poets are open to having a scene like that and not following novelistic convention, right? That's not going to be the beginning of a thread. That's not going to be a character that recurs. That's going to be a stanza, and we're going to move on to the next image, even though it's going to linger, right?
I read a review on Goodreads by Roxane Gay, and her review of Leaving the Atocha Station was very brief. I can read it in its entirety. No, no, no. Beautiful writing at the sentence level. Often funny. Too much meditation about the nature and meaning of art. I just hate those kinds of books. I like stories. She's not ostensibly wrong. The plotting of the novel is, you know, it's not the reason for reading it. But it's obviously an issue for Roxane Gay. Why is that not an issue for you, or why should it not be an issue for readers you might recommend this book to?
Well, I would never prescribe or dictate anyone's reaction to the novel. I mean, I think it's great that Roxane Gay feels that way and puts it out there. Thank God people read in different ways and people read for different things. There are brilliantly plotted novels that people recommend to me. And after the second page, I know I'm not going to be able to stick with it because they're just not doing things at the line level that excite me. That's just how I read. I don't think that makes me a good reader or a bad reader. It's just how I was raised to read. And it's my poetry background. So, you know, that's cool that she doesn't dig the novel, right? Other people do. And part of what is so rich about writing and about novels is that you can appreciate a book on so many different levels, and different readers can find different things. So let's keep it that way, right?
Mm-hmm. There are a couple of very dramatic events in the book. Mostly they happen off the page, in a sense. There's an instant message exchange between Adam and his friend and fellow poet, Cyrus, who's in Mexico and who recounts a horrifying trip to a river where he and his girlfriend witness a woman drown in the fast-moving current. That story takes up 10 pages, but it's told, as I mentioned, as a kind of instant message exchange. I thought that was very creative, the way it sort of materializes there in the book. We don't know who Cyrus is until that moment. It's an incident from life. But I spent a lot of time thinking about that scene because we don't experience it in a way as readers. We experience it secondhand through this exchange. Mm. I wanted to ask you about that scene and what it taught you or illuminated for you in terms of what a novelist can do, a novelist's tricks in a way.
Mm. Yeah. And it's wild, right? Because, you know, when that scene was written, it felt really exciting, actually, to encounter an entire chapter in an instant message. And it still feels exciting. You know, I reread it in anticipation of us talking, and it still feels new. And I got to be honest, right? So often those things feel so hokey to me. There's some writers who can pull it off. Jennifer Egan at the end of Goon Squad. You know, when a gymnast puts together just like a really crazy routine with like so many hard jumps, and either they're going to break every bone in their legs or they're going to land the most amazing thing. It's very high risk. And to me, Lerner and Egan, they just nail it. If I tried to do that, I don't think it flies. And I think that for most writers, it probably doesn't.
You're listening to Shelf Life with me, Aaron Hicklin, and my guest, the poet and author, Ben Perkert. His new book is The Men Can't Be Saved. We're talking about two among his favorite novels, including Leaving the Atosha Station by Ben Lerner, and Then We Came to the End by Joshua Ferris. We'll be back after this.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Bethel Woods Center for the Arts, presenting Garrison Keillor with special guest Richard Dworsky in the Event Gallery, Sunday, April 19th at 8 p.m. Tickets on sale now. Ticket information at bethelwoodscenter.org.
Scott Simon here. I know it might feel that there are a million places you can get your news, but paywalls are rising on high-quality journalism. Fact-checking is more rare, and more local outlets are closing every year. This station is reliable, accessible, and irreplaceable. And with your support, we'll be here for you for years to come. So please donate today, and thank you.
Make your donation at wjffradio.org.
Sign up for Radio Catskill's free weekly newsletter. Get the latest local news, culture, and things to do in your inbox every Friday. Stay connected and informed with Radio Catskill's newsletter. Subscribe at wjffradio.org.
Hello, you're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin, and my guest on this episode is Ben Perkert, the author of The Men Can't Be Saved. We're talking about two among his favorite novels, including Leaving the Atosha Station by Ben Lerner, and Then We Came to the End by Joshua Ferris. Ben, it's time to talk about Joshua Ferris's Then We Came to the End. This is a book I had the distinct pleasure of reading not long after it came out. Then We Came to the End is set within a Chicago ad agency staffed by various creatives who while away their days procrastinating, gossiping, and ultimately trying to save their skins during brutal rounds of layoffs. The novel was nominated for the National Book Award. It won the Penn Hemingway Award and was named one of the New York Times top 10 books of 2007. And Ferris himself was named to the New Yorker's list of 20 under 40 writers. So it has no shortage of fans. One of the tricks that Ferris pulls off here is to write in the first person plural, the we voice. Jeffrey Eugenides did it in his novel, The Virgin Suicides, but it's extremely rare. What makes it such a suitable voice for this novel, Ben?
Yeah, I love that question because to me, the agency is such a cast of characters. And my favorite part of Joshua Ferris's book, frankly, is the opening, is those opening 50 or 60 pages where, you know, it's like whack-a-mole, right? It's like this crazy copywriter and then this crazy copywriter and then this design, you know, and each one has an axe to grind. So-and-so thinks that their desk chair is being stolen and this other one is upset because, you know, they want the view and their desk doesn't have a good view. I mean, whatever it is, right? The concerns are so small. But that first person plural, that's a hard one to write in. And I think he just nails it.
Yes, I was going to say that despite the fact that there is no central protagonist, we do get an amazing picture of the various people who work at the agency, Karen Wu, Frank Brizolera, Hank Neary, Tom Moder, Don Blattner. They all represent different types of personalities on a kind of continuum from bouncy and upbeat and invested to bitter and disenchanted. We see how they joke around, play tricks, and irritate one another. Benny Schatzberger spends an entire day speaking nothing but quotes from the movie The Godfather. It's very funny. How true is that to your experience of working in an office? Did you encounter people like this?
I absolutely did. And I think anyone who works in an office, this is their experience. Creative agencies, branding agencies, advertising agencies, they maybe attract a particular kind of person that lends themselves to these sorts of eccentricities. But I don't know anyone who works in an office who doesn't have stories to tell. And that's what makes a book like Joshua Ferris is so entertaining. And hopefully if folks pick up my novel, they'll find the same, right? You can identify with those people down the hall who are always blasting music at the weirdest times, or, you know, who microwave their tuna sandwiches and it smells up the whole office. That is the texture of a place.
So we've talked a little about the unreliable narrators or liars, as you described them, in Leaving the Atocha Station by Ben Lerner and your new novel, The Men Can't Be Saved. It's a little different in this book than We Came to the End, because it's not a single narrator. It's this sort of hive mind, in a sense. It's the office as a whole. But they're no more reliable, are they, than the protagonists of Ben Lerner's novel or yours?
No, they're not. And I think, you know, thank God that they're not, right? Because that's what it's really like working in an office. And, you know, Joshua Ferris's book is so clearly a satire. That's how it's labeled, right? We've got this designation of workplace satire, and I think it falls pretty neatly into that category. But at the same time, I personally don't love that word satire. I think that it sometimes distances us from the realism of the characters in a book. And so is it satirical? Absolutely. But I 100% feel reading Ferris's novel that all those people are real. You know, the one who just uses the quotes from The Godfather all the time, like, he is real, right? I know that guy. So, but maybe I'm just a dummy, because Michael Scott from The Office, he also feels real to me, you know?
Right, right. There's also a character in this office who is a would-be novelist who is working on a novel about work at the end of this book. He invites all his former colleagues, as they now are, to a reading of his novel. I couldn't help but wonder if you had some particular empathy for that character, since you must have been taking notes yourself when you were working in a creative agency for The Men Can't Be Saved.
I mean, I was that guy, absolutely. But I also think that a lot of people who work at agencies are on some level that person. A lot of my friends who are graphic designers, they didn't necessarily dream of being graphic designers when they quote unquote grew up. Not that there's anything wrong with that path, but a lot of them went to art school and they wanted to be artists in the same way that I wanted to be a poet and a creative writer. And on some level, the agency needs that. The good agencies have wannabe artists, and not just wannabe artists, have real artists. The joke is the guy who has the novel in his drawer for 30 years and it's no good. And, you know, he's a frustrated writer at heart. But let me tell you, right, there's a lot of incredible writers and artists who publish and produce and have gallery shows and all the rest. They just happen to work at agencies. So it's a mix, right?
There is one character who breaks out of that sort of omniscient first person plural, and it's Lynn Mason. She's the boss of the agency. We first encounter her through the sort of gossip of the workers. But then she takes over in the third person during part two of the book. It takes place on the eve of her mastectomy. Why do you think Ferris felt the need to give Lynn Mason her own voice there?
You know, I think part of the joy of a novelist is that sometimes you make a choice to give a character a voice, and then sometimes the character just takes the microphone, right? And I mean, part of me wants to say that it's not that he gave Lynn her voice, it's that she became real and she asserted herself on the page, which is the greatest joy. I don't know how Joshua Ferris wrote it. I don't know if he mapped it out and he always knew that she was going to take up that part of the novel the way that she did, but it didn't feel that way to me. And it's interesting because I hadn't thought about Lerner's book and Joshua Ferris's book in similar terms, but now that we're talking about them, it makes me think that maybe I am drawn to sort of structural irregularities on some level. But anyway, be that as it may, I think the comedy of Ferris's opening would get stale if extended throughout the entire conceit of the novel. So on some level, I think we also need Lynn and her story, because the minute Lynn's mastectomy comes onto the page, the whole mood changes. And now the novel deepens.
I liked about it that it was a counterintuitive choice, I thought, in that it humanizes the boss by giving her a voice, her own voice. You know, we tend to think of bosses as villains. Mm. And I thought what Ferris was doing, unintentionally or not, was to give the boss a kind of agency that made you see her insecurities. We get the insecurities of the workers sort of underneath her. But when she's narrating the story, we get to see her insecurities, which are to do with her mortality, to do with her diagnosis, fearing the doctor. She doesn't fear the boss because she is the boss, but she fears the doctor. I thought that was kind of a masterstroke, actually, because it gave you a perspective that I think would have been elided otherwise. And then at the end, when we have the novelist reading his debut novel, it turns out that Ferris has played a bit of a meta game on us, right? Because the novel repeats some of Lynn Mason's narrative from the second part. So we're left wondering if, in fact, that is also unreliable. That is, there's also perhaps not Lynn Mason, but a version of Lynn Mason created by the novelist. It made me think this is also a book about craft, about the craft of the novel.
You know, I like your read, and I also think it dimensionalizes the title. Then We Came to the End. Is that about getting the axe at work and losing your job? Or is that more about Lynn's very real concerns around her own mortality? Or is it about the end of the novel? I think it's all of those things. And I think a novel has to flex in that way. If it feels too tidy, it maybe isn't fully complete.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin, and my guest for this episode is the novelist Ben Perkert. Ben, I think it's time for a short excerpt from Then We Came to the End. Let's hear it.
Karen Wu always had something new to tell us, and we hated her guts for it. She would start talking, and our eyes would glaze over. Might it be true, as we sometimes feared on the commute home, that we were callous, unfeeling individuals, incapable of sympathy and full of spite toward people for no reason other than their proximity and familiarity? We had these sudden revelations that employment, the daily 9-to-5, was driving us far from our better selves. Should we quit? Would that solve it? Or were those qualities innate, dooming us to nastiness and paucity of spirit? We hoped not. Marcia Dwyer became famous for sending an email to Genevieve Latko Devine. Marcia often wrote to Genevieve after meetings. "It is really irritating to work with irritating people," she once wrote. There she ended it and waited for Genevieve's response. Usually, when she got Genevieve's email, instead of writing back, which would take too long, Marcia was an art director, not a writer, she would head down to Genevieve's office, close the door, and the two women would talk. The only thing bearable about the irritating event involving the irritating person was the thought of telling it all to Genevieve, who would understand better than anyone else. But the email Marcia got back was not from Genevieve. It was from Jim Jackers. "Are you talking about me?" he wrote. Amber Ludwig wrote, "I'm not Genevieve." Benny Schossberger wrote, "I think you goofed." Tom Moda wrote, "Ha." Marcia was mortified. She got 65 emails in 2 minutes. One from HR cautioned her against sending personal emails. Jim wrote a second time, "Can you please tell me, is it me, Marcia? Am I the irritating person you're talking about?"
And that was an excerpt from Joshua Ferris's Then We Came to the End, one of two among Ben Perkert's favorite novels. I'm talking with Ben Perkert about his new novel, The Men Can't Be Saved. Ben, how does a novel like this, or indeed your novel, The Men Can't Be Saved, read post-pandemic? You started your novel in 2014. Obviously, Joshua Ferris wrote his a lot longer ago, and it's set in 2001. But already, office culture feels quite different than it did pre-pandemic. Mm. For a start, so many of us work remote now. Does that change how these books read to us?
It's interesting. I think that we are more nostalgic for it, maybe. That's not to say that we all want to go back to the office immediately. And, you know, I teach creative writing at a university. So I'm not working in that kind of office place setting anymore. And I know a lot of friends who are, though, and they, you know, they don't want to go back to the office. I mean, they love the convenience of working from home. It seems ridiculous to have to go back to a 5-day work week and having to endure the commute and all of that. But I do also think that in fiction and in film, this is part of the joys, right? We can go back to the office in a movie without having to commute. We can go back to the office in a novel without having to commute. We can just be transported there. Listen, at some moments I was worrying, is my novel still going to feel relevant? Is anyone going to care about, working in an ad agency if people aren't even in the office anymore? I mean, these concerns are always, I think they're sort of empty. Because if you're asking, is my art contemporary enough or is it trendy enough? Like those aren't the questions. Ask, is it good enough? Does it make you care? Yeah. Does it make you bleed? Does it make you laugh? Does it make you think? Those are the questions that I want to be asking.
And what are the challenges for you as a poet turned novelist or poet slash novelist? And what is the difference between writing a poem or a book of poems, such as For the Love of Endings, which is your first collection of poetry, versus a novel like The Men Can't Be Saved?
I think it's a pretty massive difference. Part of the reason writing this novel took me 10 years is because I had the toolbox of a poet. So imagery, metaphor, trying to get every line right, that was where I was comfortable. But thinking about plot, thinking about macro structure, those things were really challenging for me. So I wrote the first draft of this novel incredibly quickly. It was a whirlwind. It was the most fun I'll ever have as a writer, probably, because I didn't really know what the hell I was doing. And then it took 9.5 years of really hard revising and shaping and molding while still keeping the spirit of what I had made at the beginning.
Spending so much time on a novel must raise the stakes tremendously in terms of the expectation or the anticipation around publication. It can be very disorienting, I'm sure. What does that do to your sense of where next, what next, of who you are when suddenly this project is done?
How do I answer that? I'm a very anxious person. And a question like that touches on that anxiety, because I can even feel it in my chest a little bit, like, oh, crap, you know, what is my next project? But it helps me to have multiple things going on at the same time. And that also is part of the appeal of crossing over genre. Would I have been devastated had this novel not sold? Will I be devastated if no one buys it? Yeah, that will be really difficult for me to process. At the same time, the whole thing feels like an experiment. The whole thing feels like taking a risk. And I'm still writing poems and I'm working on another novel. And so, yeah, at the risk of sounding like a financial advisor or something, just diversifying, right? Like having lots of different assets, having lots of different hands in different projects, that helps me get over the fear of putting too much weight on the singular thing.
I'm looking forward to your second novel and whatever comes next from the desk of Ben Perkert, who's been my guest today on this episode of Shelf Life. Ben, thank you so much. This has been wonderful.
Oh, Aaron, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
We've been talking about Then We Came to the End by Joshua Ferris, published by Back Bay Books, and Leaving the Atocha Station by Ben Lerner, published by Coffee House Press. The Men Can't Be Saved by Ben Perkert is published by Overlook. My thanks, as always, to my producer, Ilya Maritz, and sound engineer and composer, Tim Wood. Shelf Life is a production of Grand Journal and One Grand Books in collaboration with WJFF Radio Catskill. And if you like the show, you can find plenty more on Apple and Spotify with guests such as Alan Cumming, John Waters, Ari Shapiro, Kevin Barry, and Joyce Maynard. While you're there, why not give us a 5-star rating that will help others find the show?
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Neversink General Store, featuring catering for parties, meetings, and weddings, gourmet deli, pizzeria, and groceries inside a gas station. NeversinkGeneralStore.com, and from listeners like you.
Do you listen to Radio Catskill?
Oh, yeah, I always have. I like it because it's my people. It's my community.
And yes, I do listen to Radio Catskill. It's been my company.
It plays my favorite music.
I like that there is a variety of programming that you can't find anywhere else.
It lets me know what's going on in my community, and it gives me good news. I feel like I'm really connected to my community when I listen to it.
Give now at WJFFradio.org.
WJFF Jeffersonville. You're listening to Radio Catskill.